Accession number 20478, Reel 1.
Jack French, Reel 1. Where were you born, please?
In Teignmouth, South Devon.
Which year was this?
1926.
Did you grow up and have your schooling in Teignmouth?
Half my schooling was at Westlawn, Teignmouth. Then we passed over to Ashburton in South Devon when I was about 11 years old.
How old were you when you left school?
14.
So this must have been in 1940. Sounds like it.
Yeah, it'd be about that, yeah.
Mm. So you spent the war years in Ashburton?
Part of the war years. I volunteered for the Navy during the war years.
Did Ashburton get any bombing during the war?
No, there was just a flying, I think they called them mines, was dropped out over the moors, which is about 7 miles outside of Ashburton. But I think it was offloading of the actual load, probably after the bombing of Plymouth.
So were people in Ashburton much affected by the war?
Well, personally myself, I was in the St. John's ambulance, and we were on call to go to Plymouth when the severe bombing of Plymouth, but we never went to Plymouth. But we used to sleep in the ambulance hall of a night time in case we were called upon.
Can you tell me about volunteering for the Navy, please?
When I was 17, I volunteered to join the Navy. It was always my intention as a youngster to join the Navy.
How did you go about it?
I just rode off and volunteered my services.
And then?
I was sent to Exeter to complete the actual intelligence tests and visual tests, and told to await further notification.
When did that come?
That would have been to join in November 1943 and go to Skegness, which was in them days Butland's holiday camp, where we done our initial square bashing, route marches, rifle drill. We were there for about a month. Then we go on to Wetherby in Yorkshire. We had a camp opposite the racecourse where we done knots, practice rowing on what you might call a stock, which had a pool the other side, to learn how to manage an oar. We also had our second lot of jabs there. From there, I was drafted then to Aberdeen, where we lived in civilian billets and attended the Marconi Radio College in Aberdeen.
Had you wanted to go into the signal side?
Oh yes, definitely. Mainly because a friend of mine, he was on the Duke of York. He was a sparker as well, and was in the hunting of the pocket battleship. I forget its name now.
Never mind, not the Scharnhorst.
No, Bismarck, wasn't it?
What happened to you in Aberdeen?
Well, there we'd done all our Morse and technical course, and when we completed that, we were then drafted to Ayrshire, which was another Butland's holiday camp, to start doing crypto.
What was that?
For coding and all the different types of ciphers in publication at that time.
And then?
From then, well, I might add that throughout this time we never had any leave, because unfortunately there were leave bans on nearly every time that our break-in courses would normally allow us to take leave. So we had to be content with no leave at all. And it was 10 months before I got home again. We then got drafted down to Devonport Barracks. And it must have been about the time when they were getting ready for the landings at Normandy. Because they were drastically overcrowded, and we even had to sit on the floor to have our meals. It was that overcrowded. I then, in November, had a 2.5 year commission to South Africa, the South Atlantic. I think the intention, as far as I can gather, was that they had intended to have a combined ops landing in
Singapore?
No, the
Sumatra?
Where the Chindits were.
Burma.
Burma, that's right, Burma. But fortunately, Lord Wingate, as he became, and the Chindits had the big push across the top of Burma, which fortunately we weren't required for that. I was then drafted to Cape Town Radio, which is a little place called Slangkop, and spent nearly 3 years at the radio station there. I came home in March 1947, and we passed the royal family, which was on the battleship Warspite, I think that's correct, Warspite, just off Freetown, and came home to the severe aftermath of the winter of 1947. So virtually, I didn't leave the house for the first week because of the sudden change in temperatures. I was home in UK about 3 months when I suddenly got a sudden draft to go to the Falkland Islands. Now, normally, AFO, the Admiralty Fleet Orders, stipulated that you had to be in UK at least 6 months before you could be giving another foreign draft. But when I put in about that, the excuse was that there was so many people being demobbed, it had to be disregarded. We were in the barracks because we spend our time at the signal school to keep our practices going.
Which barracks is this?
The naval barracks in Devonport. But during the periods between waiting for draft, we go to the signal school, which was then out at Glen Oak, close to where they built the new road bridge to Saltash, which was an ex-American camp. It was whilst we were in waiting to be drafted early the following morning that out came a signal saying that because of the shortage of people, that they were going to close down a lot of ships and establishments. And one of the places happened to be the Falkland Islands. It was our intention to have gone to Southampton, boarded an American passenger liner, travelled first class to New York, then had a railway trip from there down to Montevideo, and await the next pickup for the Falklands. So being single, most of us, that we were really looking forward to the experience. But unfortunately, one of the POs was married, had different thoughts, and he phoned the Admiralty right away, and the outcome was that they said, you better hold on to the draft until further instructions come along. So we didn't make it. I then went back on the what they called the Foreign Service Pool, which is just a standby for the next draft to go abroad. Unfortunately, in the meantime, I went back to the signal school to carry on keeping our hands going on the signals expertise, as you may say. When the last draft of the year, sometime in November, went out at 8 o'clock that morning. And I was rubbing my hands because it would be the first time I would have been not only at home, but also not abroad for Christmas. Unfortunately, about 11 o'clock, I was called for to go to the drafting office to discover that somebody had gone sick, and I had to pack my kit, pick up with the draft that had already gone into the barracks for 2.5 years in Ceylon. I then went to Ceylon West Receiving Station and was there until January 1949, when the East Indies station changed over from Devonport commitment to Portsmouth commitment and was drafted on the next trooper, which was
doesn't matter about the name
For onward passage to Hong Kong. But because the trooper had a case of chickenpox and measles, she curtailed her journey at Singapore, and we were all offloaded. And we went to HMS Terror under quarantine.
I think the troop ship was Donero, wasn't it?
That is correct, yeah. I couldn't remember. It was whilst there that I was suddenly piped for one evening at about 9 o'clock and told to report to the drafting office, where I was informed that I would be picking up the tug at 5 o'clock in the morning that was going out to sea to meet up with the Amethyst and doing a transfer at sea for a person who was coming in for his lead and tells course. I told them, I'm afraid I can't go, whereupon the RPO said, what do you mean you can't go? And I said, well, I've been here now 3 or 4 days under quarantine, not even allowed to leave the station. And he told me to go away and listen for the pipes. At about 9:45, up came the pipe, went down to Discovery. I got hold of the base medical officer who had sanctioned me to join the Amethyst. Thus, in the morning, I was away at 5 o'clock on a jeep, or a tilly, I think they call them, and I had all my kit with me, got as far as the dockyard when the driver turned around to me and says, where to, master? And I said, well, didn't they tell you where you had to go? myself, having just joined Singapore, having no knowledge of what the sectionalisation of Singapore dockyards was, hadn't a clue where he had to go. I noted there was a signal tower further along, so I told him to make for there, thinking that that would be manned and they could tell me where the tugs were. Unfortunately, during the night, it wasn't manned. I was then wandering around trying to see if anybody was about when all of a sudden the person appeared and I said, "Oh, excuse me, can you tell me where the tugs go from in the harbour?" Being a massive harbour, of course, Singapore. And he says, well, you're very fortunate. He says, "I'm the captain of the tug." I said, "Thank Christ for that." And that's how I come to join the Amethyst. We then done three tours on Malayan patrols off the East Coast, searching dhows for ammunition, drugs, and even slave trade. It was then, after those patrols, that we were then drafted set to sail to Hong Kong to pick up reliefs for the ship, and also the captain's wife was aboard. We spent the next couple of weeks carrying out exercises with the new bombardment code and procedures came into force, whereby the army provided a spotter and we were given instructions of how to guide our guns for a bombardment. We then sailed for Shanghai, intending to relieve the Black Swan in Shanghai. When we got to Shanghai, it was discovered that we were not going to relieve the Black Swan. We were going to carry on up the river and relieve the Concorde. There was an Australian ship that was detailed in the original forecast, but they decided not to let her go up the river. That is the Australian government. So we were detailed to go up the river in its place. Okay. On the 19th of April, at 8 o'clock in the morning, we slipped from Holt's Wharf in Shanghai and proceeded up the river. At about 4 o'clock that day, we came to Quang Yin, where the Chinese, or a gathering of Chinese ships, warships, were collected in an anchorage and requested permission to anchor for the night. They gave us permission provided we black out the ship, which we did. We stopped overnight and at about 5:15 in the morning, we started to sail for Nanking. We hadn't been moving for about half an hour when we hit fog, so we anchored the ship and proceeded again at 7:30. I was on the morning watch at that time and went off at 8 o'clock to go down and have a wash, breakfast, before starting work again at 9 o'clock, which was the recognised thing. It would have been about 9:15. No, sorry, before that, it was about 8:30 that small arms fire was fired at the ship. But it only lasted for about 10 minutes or so. We couldn't find out where the firing was coming. So we just carried on, and the firing ceased. So we carried on our merry way. It would be about 9:15 when the heavy shelling by artillery started. There were hits in the captain's cabin, the wheelhouse, the bridge, and the low power room. It was unfortunate that we were navigating around Rose Island, which is in a sharp bend of the Yangtze River. So we had a port on, and of course we had increased our speed as a consequence of the firing, although we could only do 18 knots maximum. Unfortunately, as a consequence of the wheelhouse, then the bridge being hit, people were knocked out of station for quite some considerable time. And after they had come round, it was a bit too late to discover that we were heading for the nationalist side of the river. I think also the telegraphs were knocked out of commission and could get no decent communications between the bridge and the power engine room. As a consequence, we ran aground at full speed into the mud surrounding the bend in the river. We were firing back by our X-gun, the AMB unfortunately not being able to train until such time as the X-gun received a direct hit, and that completely disposed of our heavy armament. There were such things as Oricans, Sten guns and rifles available, but of no avail for what was required for an incident like that. We were taking such a massive damage that it was decided to evacuate the ship with the full intention of coming back aboard during the night hours to try and get the ship afloat.
Before you go any further, can I ask you what it was like for you when the ship was being hit?
Well, I had just come off the morning watch, and of course, when we went to action stations, I was more or less a spare hand, as you might say, having just come up, trying to get my breakfast and also getting washed. And whilst I was there, they shouted into... during the bombardment, both the doctor and the sick bay attendant was killed. And all of a sudden, they opened the door and asked if somebody could be spared to assist the wounded down in the mess deck. So I volunteered to go down because I was in the St. John's ambulance before I joined the Navy. And... no doubt about it, it was pandemonium in the after mess deck, bodies lying everywhere, some of which I don't wish to go into the state of their well-being. So I then spent time down in the mess deck assisting the wounded until the evacuate ship orders went out. Now, whenever you do that, either abandon ship or evacuate ship, you have to dispose of your secret, top secret publications and machinery, such as coding equipments. So we spent the next half an hour or so burning documents. I myself was breaking up the Typex machine before disposing of it over the side, as well as smashing inserts.
Was it easy to destroy the Typex machine?
This was the funny thing. That in the WT office, you had a massive spanner, the size of which would be used on equipment such as cranes for undoing bolts, and also an hammer. Believe you me, trying to break steel, which the actual drums were made of, it's a lost cause. It just bounces back at you, and you're liable to do more damage to your body than you do to the equipment. But with the inserts, you were able to crack them up, and we had to depend on cutting the wires before disposing of the equipment. I would say that myself and a PO seaman, plus a lead and tow, were about the last to get off the ship of the people that actually went. Unfortunately, the lead and tow couldn't swim very well, so we decided to go over with him and swim and push to assist him to get ashore. Well, with the run of the river, you literally had to swim upstream and allow the tide to take you into the bank. So by the time we got in there, I was completely worn out. And there was about an 8-foot bank that had to be climbed to get up onto the fields that surrounded the river. So before I'd done that, I was that puffed. I got down behind one of the Carly floats to regain my strength before climbing up the bank. Whilst I was down there, the gunnery officer was shouting out to people to volunteer to take the whaler back. When I did look around, I discovered I was the only one in the water and really had no option but to go back on the whaler. Having come off the morning watch, I was in white shirt and serge trousers. And we got halfway across in the whaler when I literally heard a whiz above my head, and it suddenly struck me I had my white front on and I was a sitting target. So I literally shipped my oar, got down into the bowels of the whaler, and literally ripped off my white front before carrying on rowing. All this time, while people were swimming in the river, and the people that couldn't swim were manning the whaler and acting as stretcher bearers, they were still shelling people in the water. And as a consequence of this, the whaler had to go up river to have the bows of the ship, or the complete ship, shielding its passage. And we wound up at the bows of the ship when the electrical officer was still on deck and shouting down if there was a sparker aboard. And when they discovered that I was aboard, they literally tossed a rope down over and pulled me up on the bows of the ship. And from then on, my time was in the WT office continuously manning the circuits for 6 days with the help, eventually, when the RAF doctor came aboard, dosed me with Benzedrine to keep me awake.
What kind of signals were you handling?